Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I think a lot of people running things have a crazy addiction to setting things up and are just absolutely awful, me included, at celebrating. And like, I never look backwards at all. I'm going to die and not remember anything, I'm afraid.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Balancing Acts. In this conversation, I talk to the founder of Hoopla Impro, Steve Rowe. Perfect. Hi, this is Steve Whiteley, comedian, actor, filmmaker and writer, all-round ADHD creative. And welcome to my new podcast, Balancing Acts, where I talk to an array of creatives ranging from comedians, actors, directors, all sorts. And we talk about how they find a sense of balance or not between their creative lives and their everyday lives and how that has an impact on their mental health and beyond. Balancing Acts is made in association with The Comedy Crowd, who support independent comedy creators. They showcase the best new videos on comedycrowdtv.com and across media platforms. They support independent comedy creators and showcase the best new videos, including adult animation, sketch shows, web series, viral hits, and lots more. So if you're a creator, then do check them out. In 2006, Steve Rowe and Edgar Fernando founded Hoopla. At first, it was a few mates mucking about at the back of a pub on stage, and from there, it grew and grew and grew. Hoopla has now founded the UK's first improv theatre and runs a whole host of improv classes and courses on top of improv-based corporate training. I met Steve way back in the day. I'd been doing some improv sort of drama workshops, and then I stumbled across Hoopla, and I was like, yes, this is what I've been looking for. It was very sort of comedic. It was lots of fun. There was a social dynamic to it, and it opened up a whole world to me. I've been meaning to sit down and talk with Steve for a while, so it's great that we found the time to chat and talk about the whole journey Steve has been on with Hoopla from those early days to the successful company it is now. Steve talks about how he found Hoopla and eventually walked out of his full-time job in TV to commit to growing it as a company. He explains why not to fall into the trap of being the impoverished artist. We discuss why temping jobs can be a meditative process. Steve explains the pros and cons of growing a company organically over not taking investment. The struggle of transitioning from being a performer to having to take a step back to run the business. And why you should be okay to sacrifice projects and ideas so you can focus on doing one thing really well. Steve also breaks down his circle method decision-making process, which we spin off into our own startup idea, which eventually makes us millions and millions. But unfortunately, I then order a hitman on Steve because I decided I want to have the business for myself. But that, more on that later in the episode. Steve talks about the importance of focusing on the audience and what's fun rather than worrying about the competition, how and why Hoopla opened their improv venue, what to do when you get to the end of your five-year plan. Steve talks about why he took a management course with Open University and what the key takeaways he learned from that were. He explains how he got better at delegating. He breaks down the five whys you need to ask yourself before you launch something new. Steve also describes the healthy state that the UK improv scene was in pre-COVID and how it's on track to compete with the US and also describe some of the issues in the US improv scene. We talk about the Alexander technique, why he did a course in hypnotherapy during COVID, what his annual birthday ritual is, why he loves going on solo walks, and loads more. There is just untold amount of nuggets in this conversation. So this is super useful if you are someone that is running a creative business, or if you are thinking about running a creative business, then this is the episode for you. If you have a interest in improv, or if you are thinking about learning improv or getting involved in performing in improv shows, then this is also for you. So lots to soak in on this one. I watched that that documentary on North Korea. I don't know if anyone saw that on BBC iPlayer, The Mole, who goes undercover. You know, it's a very fascinating watch, but it just makes me think, yeah, what am I doing with my life? You know, my life is utterly boring. In comparison to that, I want to be a mole. So if anybody out there needs a mole, I'm up for it. I don't know what for. I want some excitement in my life. That's what I felt that guy who was the mole. It's no spoilers, etc. But I felt that part of the reason why he wanted to do it, because he was just bored at home. It's why people do a lot of things, don't they? Just bored. So yeah, I want to switch things up a little bit. Talking of which, I've signed up to this amazing platform called Lunch Club, where they set you up with people with similar interests, and then you have these conversations on video and just brainstorm ideas. And it's been a lot of fun. I haven't really gone on there for a specific reason, just because I'm bored, isn't it? And just asking people if they need a mole. So far, no one's been forthcoming. Okay, without further ado, over to Steve Rowe. Perfect. Steve Rowe in the fucking building via Zoom.
Hello, Steve. Hello. How are you? That's not just me saying hello to myself. Steve, wow.
Shall we pitch a new idea for a podcast series called Two Steves and a Mic?
It sounds a bit filthy, but I like it.
two Steves and Mic.
Yes, two Steves and Mic. Yeah. I'm up for that.
Great. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I'm not one to brag, but I just got back from the gym just in time for this podcast.
Oh, fantastic.
I'm not usually a gym goer, but I've just started the last 2 months. So now I'm one of these people that is new to the gym and is utterly convinced that their whole body has changed. It just could have been like five times, but that's how I feel.
Did you go to the gym prior to lockdown shenanigans?
I used to be more into running and swimming, but then since I was gonna mention this on the podcast, but it's popped up. But I actually had COVID back in March.
Oh shit!
It's not a hoax, folks. I always felt like shit for months, and so for some reason,
I know that
is now gone. So I'm having to find a new to get back into it. So I still can't run very much. But I found like things like rowing machines and like weights and stuff. So I'm kind of like, I'm totally healthy. So I've recovered, but I did have a couple of months of being like really quite rubbish, not hospital, but like extreme fatigue and like aerobic fitness has gone. But it is getting better bit by bit. So this is my kind of path to recovery.
Shit. So are you bedridden?
Yeah. For a good week or so I was. And then, but then also, as you might've heard, how much people get. I had a good couple of months where you know, I could get up and do like maybe 3 hours work a day or something a day, but then the rest of the time I'd just be asleep. But I was just sleeping like an unbelievable amount, although I think actually it was also because I've been going pretty full-on with Hoopla for years before March, so I think it was partly, I mean, it was COVID, but then also I think I was long overdue a bit of a wipeout. And right. I think when I ran anything for the first time in years, I think my body just gave up over April and May. So, but now I'm kind of on the up again.
Well, that's good to hear.
Thanks.
I don't know if you can hear, there's a bloody building works going on next door. They always seem to resume. I'm gonna ask them if they can stop drilling, just to be on the safe side. If I don't come back, it's because they've killed me. I'm going to be one sec.
So while Steve's gone, everyone, he's still recording. So I'm going to tell you what's in his room in Zoom. So he's in his bedroom. It's quite tidy, actually. He's got a double bed So he's either with someone or he's optimistic, or just wants some space. I'm not one to judge. Next to his bed, there's a pot plant that's doing well. So we know that he can look after things. It's because it's green and it's grown way taller than it should because it's now touching the slope ceiling. So it looks like that's been with him for some time. There's some coloured lighting balls on the headstead, the sort of thing you might pick up on a day trip to Brighton in the lanes, I'd imagine. And above those, there's some art. There's two men without faces, and one of them looks a bit like the guy who wrote Seinfeld and wrote Curb Your Enthusiasm, his name I can't remember, but they don't have faces. And it's quite interesting. It looks like a kind of mentor talking to a younger man. Hi, Steve.
I'm alive, and it went all right. It went all right. I was very sort of like timid, and excuse me. Yeah. And, we're just recording a podcast about creativity next door.
No, you said that.
If you wouldn't, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. yeah, they've stopped. Fantastic.
I would have never have done that. So big respect to you for doing that.
I've done it a few times. I think they really fucked off with me. this is like the fourth or fifth time I've done it. Okay, so back to where we were. So in a way, or it's a long time coming, you having this physical breakdown of sorts because you have been slogging it out running Hoopla for, well, you launched Hoopla. Well, you established it very casually with friends in 2006. Is that right?
Yeah. That's well researched and remembered. Early days, my friend. You and Josh were one of the first people along. So yeah, it started as a kind of, just doing it for fun. I still do it for fun, but just doing it for fun in spare time around work with friends coming along to a free, free drop-in workshop at the Bedford in Balham, which is quite a big comedy pub in South London.
Yeah.
And it was just, like the main aim for it at the time, we didn't have any big plan, was just, works can be boring and stressful sometimes. It can be exciting, but you've got to have a place in life, I think, where you can go and be yourself and fuck around, be a dickhead, specialise, have a drink, and just do all the human stuff that you can't do at work in your normal 9-to-5 or 9-to-7 or whatever people do these days. And also the kind of birth of it was, I grew up in London like yourself and went to uni. When I came back, I met all these people who were new to London. And to them, London was a scary place. But I used to bump into school friends on the Northern Line like all the time. So I got together with my old GCSE drama group. That was like the first Hoopla group. And we were like, well, let's just do the last time life was super fun, which in London, which was for us GCSE drama days, because that was just like such a good laugh, just devising plays and improvising and then going to the pub afterwards, which is basically our life through the whole of GCSEs. So we were like, let's start that up. And then, as you go on in London, you just meet other people. More and more people would come along. You just meet kind of similar minded folk. And before you know it, you're having a good time once a week. So, yeah, we just sort of went from there. And it wasn't at the start of it. It wasn't going to be my job. But then about 5 years into that, I was like, actually, I do really like this. And I think there's an opportunity to really, double down and make the most of it. So that's when we went and turned it into a professional thing.
It was amazing. Like, it's been amazing watching that journey from afar, from, like you said, those early days where we just do these workshops at the Bedford, to then putting on the first live show, because up till then there wasn't any live shows. And then that was like a whole big, adventure. And then to see you sort of grow it from then, because I remember at that time you were working in TV.
Yeah.
And you dip in and out, right? You go and do a TV production job. You working for, was it the Discovery Channel?
Yeah. I was working for History Channel.
Okay.
Working for production companies that make stuff for the History Channel at the time.
Okay.
And then different ones. I used to work in, say, some science TV, some food TV.
Yeah.
So it's like a pivotal moment for me where this is the sort of thing I maybe say on your podcast, what I'm about to say. So I, I walked out of a TV job, but I mean, in quite a kind of overly Amdram dramatic way, where I got this like, this really presumed good job where it was working with Richard Hammond on this sort of engineering show. And it was a good show as well, Engineering Connections. It was combining like loads of my interests, like science, but done in a kind of fun, engaging way. Really lovely company called Darlow Smithson. They're really good. If you're listening, any of you out there, I'm really sorry how shit I was there. And then, and it was really well paid. And I was like, fuck, this is, and you know, I'd kind of done the hard work there. And I was kind of like, right, this actually is a career that I could do. But then as I was in it, and later, I was doing some other TV jobs that year, I just sort of saw Hoopla dying, because obviously the two things just don't go together. Like, you can't really be working on a shoot that's going for, 20 hours a day, or working on these huge things that build up to something, and then also be dashing off at 5 to go and teach a drama club in Balham. Yeah, and there was like a pivotal moment where I was like, fuck, I'm fucking up our first Edinburgh show. Which I was really looking forward to anyway. And then there's this younger guy there who was really clever, and he was really fucking good, and he was tons better at the job than me. And his contract was only 3 weeks, whereas mine was like long term. Anyway, one day I just sort of walked out of the office, even though it was middle of work. I just emailed the production manager saying, sorry, I can't do this anymore. And then I went and sat on Hampstead Heath like a complete dramatic fool. And I just sat on Hampstead Heath, and I was like, what the fuck, why am I doing this? I feel like I'm going mad. And I sat on a bench. I can't remember, is it Parliament Hill, the one that overlooks London?
Yeah,
you know, that's more your area. I don't know. And I could just see like London in the distance. And at the time I was thinking like, is it possible to, make a living from Hoopla, which I really love. And then from that viewpoint, you see like loads of London. And it just hit me. I was like, there's fucking millions of people in London. Well, obviously this was pre-lockdown, so that was true then. Now I'm like, well, I don't know if that's true anymore. But I was like, there's millions of people there, and like nobody, like the improv scene at the time was getting a bit obsessed. There was like this minor competition between improv companies. And I was like, if you walked around London and went up to people and said, do you know what improv is? I reckon most people would still even now say no, or kind of get kind of their weird view of it. And if you said, did you know it's a thing you can do for fun in your spare time? I still think most people wouldn't know. And so it just hit me. I was like, there's like endless opportunity. I think as a kind of person going into creative industries as a job, I think that's the kind of mindset that people have to shift into. It's away from the kind of impoverished artist archetype, which you get, you know, forced into by wherever. And back into the kind of like actually opening your eyes into like how much unlimited opportunity there is all the time everywhere if you're willing to do the hard work. Anyway, so then I did go back the next day, and she printed the email and left it on my desk, and I think it emailed it around everyone else, which I thought was like, clearly I was having some mental problems at the time. I thought that was kind of, it was like before, you know, it was a bit weird to do that. So everyone went quiet when I walked in. And then I was summoned to a meeting, and they're like, what's going on? And I just said, I need to leave. They're like, when? I was like, now. I just need to do something else. And I said, but I've got a plan. I'll work out 3 weeks, and then Tristan will take over for me. He's tons better than me. And they brought him in. They're like, do you want a job long term? He's just like, yeah, it was like his dream. And they're like, oh, actually, this works out fine. So then he got I hope he's doing well on TV. He's awesome. And then that was when I kind of like almost snipped the mother's apron strings and was like, right, now I've got to do this, because I kind of like, you know, burnt a few bridges. and then I just went into temping for like a couple of years, so that I could just, you know, have enough to survive but be able to leave at four, so that
you,
I could just
went for it.
Yeah, and I used to kind of like, you know, the feeling, I was just in a job, I was at St. George's Hospital, and I was doing the work, but it was kind of just moving files around. So I just had a lot of space to think about stuff.
Yeah.
So that was helpful.
Yeah, I went through that phase as well, the temping phase. In a way, like, I found it quite fun because like a lot of people there working at that place at the same time were sort of trying to do something else as well, you know, trying to head a side hustle, or they were trying to get into creative industries, etc. And during that period, it wasn't like, I don't know about you, but like, I wasn't using loads of brain power, you know, I was just doing databases, I was just fucking around all day. So it was actually quite a fun time.
Yeah, it can be if you get the right job, it can be like almost a meditation.
Yeah.
I think. as long as you kind of preserve the dream, I think. I found that hard. There was one time when I was temping, and I mean, there's nothing wrong with temping. But, you know, I got into it for one reason. And there was this database query that I had to run on a computer. And you click go, and then it freezed up the computer. And 2 hours later, the result came back, and you emailed it off to people. And I had to do that every morning. So I said to the manager, like, what do you want me to do while that's running? And they were like, what do you mean? I said, well, I can do something else because I can't use my computer. And they're like, I don't know what you mean. I said, oh, do I just stay here? They're like, oh yeah, that's your computer. And I was like, but I can't use it for 2 hours every morning. They're like, yeah. And I was like, oh, okay. So 2 hours every morning, the first thing I do, I get in, I click this button on this Microsoft Access database. And I used to look, because you had to look like you're doing something, even though I was asking if I could do anything, but there wasn't anything else to do. And I'd look over the monitor outside, and I'd look at this tree, and I just used to look at the leaves on the tree for like 2 hours and just like daydream and think about what I was going to do with Hoopla, etc. And at the time I was like, I haven't even done anything about this, but I was writing in my head South London the musical. Anyway, so that's another story. And then I was doing this for months, and then one day a leaf fell off. And I realized it was the last leaf. And I just suddenly woke up and I was like, fuck, I've just seen all the seasons just watching this tree every morning. I'd gone from full tree to the last leaf falling off. And then I realized actually I'd been using the temp job as kind of an excuse to not really fully commit to Hoopla. I realized if I didn't have this, I'd be able to set it up. And you get to a point, it's just like, I'm just making fucking excuses, you know. Like, I finished work at 4. If I wasn't drinking the night before, I'd have loads of energy. You know, if I was going to the gym, I'd have more energy and time. If I stopped watching TV, you know, like if I'm home by 5, and like 5 hours a day every week, every day for a week, that's like a whole other job that you can do. So I just had to start treating it as like, I've got 2 full-time jobs. And then once I started doing that, then it started to come together.
So cool. Once you grew to a certain place, to a certain point, did you get investment or did you just grow it all organically?
No, never had investment. I think it would have been wise to have done so. But then again, I think if I had, I would have just splashed that money away and fucked it up.
You did it all with a shoestring.
Yes. So what we did is we just sort of gradually expanded. So we've never had any investment. The only loan I've ever had is the government kind of coronavirus bounce back loan.
Oh yeah.
You know, just in case. But no, we didn't do loans either. Yeah. So you just kind of like we were kind of just gradually expanding year on year, which I mean has its own benefits. The benefit is like, you're not in debt. There's no risk, financial risk. And you're learning as you go. So every time you do something, you've got like years of experience behind you rather than risking it. The disadvantage from a sort of business point of view is like you're possibly missing a lot of opportunities.
And you can't expand quickly.
Yeah, you can't. You're not expanding quickly enough to match the opportunity, which means that you kind of leave it wide open for other people to do that.
Yeah.
And if you're happy with that, which I am, then that's fine. But if you're not, then you have to do something about it. I think, funny enough, especially when lockdown and COVID's over and things are back to normal, I think now would be more the time that we'd be wise to get investment, because I think I'm older, we know what we're doing, and we've got like an experienced kind of administration and management team. We kind of like know how to spend investment money wisely. And we know how to like have this very specific projects that we could do. Whereas I think before, we're just sort of, I don't think we would have been very wise with it.
Yeah.
I know I've been.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I sort of like took the same approach with my production company.
Yeah.
Just freaked me out, the idea of trying to get investment, just all that responsibility and answering to somebody. It's the reason why I set up in the first place, so I didn't have to.
Yeah, I completely
have the freedom.
I think the people who set things up are, you set it up because you don't want to work for someone. You like the freedom of it. I think it's why it's a main thing, isn't it? That sometimes the people who set up companies aren't the best ones to run them.
Yeah. Longer. Was there a time where it was challenging transitioning from being like Steve, the improviser, to now like Steve, the business head honcho?
Yeah, I battle.
Deal, motherfuckers.
I've kind of made atonement with myself about that now. But yeah, I definitely battled with that a while. I think like anybody, because when you embark on creative things, there's all manner of directions you could go in.
Yeah.
I think much like yourself, because me and you were doing that Logan Murray stand-up course together back in the day, which was really fun. I think back then I was very much like, I'm a performer first. I also happen to teach, and like, that's it. And when we started to bring in other teachers, and there's a responsibility that goes with that, I did go through a bit of a battle of being like, I'm just going to bring in one or two because I'm a performer first who happens to do all this.
Yeah.
And then I think the turning point, like a lot of guys, is like when me and my wife were having a baby, like the year building up to that, I was a bit like, okay, I need to just make that decision now. So yeah, now I'm the person that runs Hoopla first and teacher who performs for fun. And I think that's the difference. So now when I perform, actually, in a way, it's kind of like more liberating. I'm not planning to be like the next Lee Evans. So when I perform, it's just like, it just feels like meeting up with friends and having a good laugh and having some drinks afterwards. But yeah, I mean, I think that is like, I don't know if I want to say that I'm able to give out success tips, but I do think that's a missing pillar of success that people miss sometimes, which is sacrifice. Because you think you've got like, obviously commitment, perseverance. I don't know what the other ones are. Every year I'm trying to do 10 things and I'm half finishing all of them, which means none of them are
finished. Yeah.
Whereas sometimes I think you've got to just be like, right, let's just let these things go for a bit and just do them for fun. And let's just put all our energy into this thing. And I find with Hoopla, the more we did that, the better it got and the more successful it got. I read it in some business books sometimes a CEO's job is to decide what we're not going to do and then spend a whole year making sure you don't do it.
Right. Okay. That's an interesting.
I was like, whoa, that's really, because there's just so many. And I think in business, sometimes there's so many, like so many people say to us all the time, like, have you ever thought about this? I'm like, yeah, of course. It's a really obvious idea. Like, have you ever thought about running kids clubs everywhere? I'm like, yeah, of course I've thought about that. It's really obvious. But I don't have resources to do that. And so I can't do a bad job of that. Like, I don't want to fuck that up.
Yeah.
So it's not doing it now or ever. And we're just focusing on adults. So there you go. You just have to decide what you're not going to do. And then not too hang up on the kind of vision. When you're down with one thing, not be like, oh, if I had pursued my stand-up now, I'd be at the O2. And
grass is always greener. That's like, it's a classic thing, isn't it, with people who are creative, that you get excited by loads of different ideas and there's so many different routes you can go down, especially when you're starting out.
Yeah.
It's difficult to commit to that one thing. I mean, now it's like slightly different. You can be... It's very common to be maybe like an actor, a writer, a director, and you can do all these different things. But I think it's also good to focus on one thing, do that really well, and then maybe branch out to something else.
Can I show you my circle thing that I do?
Yeah.
So I agree, you do have to see lots of different things now. So that means Hoopla isn't just one thing. But so what I do, when I try to make those decisions, like I just get... I write down like on a piece of paper, like every possible thing that I feel like I kind of want to do right now. And this is stuff I always do this in like a peaceful place. So don't never do it when stressed. Always do it like when I'm away from something, like sit in a park, no phone. So on that, I'll just have like a little word for each thing that I want to, that we could do as a hoop player or me personally. And then I just sort of go around in a circle each one, but I'm just really like impulsive, and just like the bigger the circle, the more I want to do it. It's more like an emotional choice. So then you end up with that.
It would look like you've drawn tits.
Well, there's maybe that as well. The subconscious comes in. And then, then I get a permanent marker. And just sometimes they connect together, these little circles, funny enough. And then I'm like, right, okay, next 6 months, I'm just going to put efforts into this stuff. And it just stops you kind of like having that kind of bullshit of like, oh, if I wasn't doing this, I could be doing this. It's like, well, just decide that so you can clear your mind so you can actually focus a little bit. So, I don't want to be writing a screenplay late at night, but thinking like, oh God, if I wasn't doing this, I would be, you know, doing stand up in Norway or whatever. So I think
want to be in Norway.
I want to be in Norway. Every couple of months, like, yeah, I do stuff like that just to decide.
That's great advice. I've never done that. I have to give that a go.
Because also I figure like, if you don't do that, then I think because when you're running your own thing, like you are creating your own job for the future. So if you don't do that, you're just going to create a shit job for yourself 5 years from now. So if you're not like viewing, if you're not checking in with yourself and be like, do I actually want to do this? Then you're kind of just making a bad job description for yourself.
I don't know about you, but sometimes when I'm at a restaurant, I find it very difficult deciding what to choose to eat. You know, if it's a really great menu, do you think this method is applicable to that? So could I go into the restaurant, write them all down, put circles around them, and then go through that for an hour, hopefully don't get booted out of the restaurant, and then tell the waiter or waitress what I want?
I think go for it. I think there's a whole bit. I think there's a whole restaurant opportunity there to give you
it's a niche
menus that you circle how much you want something, and then they create it based on your circle. A bit of pi r squared on the scene.
Like, mate, this is where we're going to make our millions.
Yeah, that'd be the name of the restaurant, pi r squared. And then, I think that's it. Let's make that. Let's do that. We should be on this podcast.
We should do that right now. Yeah, what are we doing?
We're wasting our time.
Have you got a name for that, by the way?
What?
That process. Have you got a name for it?
No.
Oh, pi r squared.
We could name it now, if you want.
Yeah.
Pi r squared. I don't just call it circles. I don't know.
Circles is very accurate. Accurate description. Yeah, we should do a circles for our idea.
Yeah. Put it on.
Yeah. I mean, we could do it for the next half an hour. Probably won't make for the best listen, but we'll have a good time.
We'll have a booming business at the end.
Oh, gosh. It's going to make us millions. Can you imagine? It makes so much. So what is it that you guys do?
Yeah, it's guys, it's Interactive Menus. That's the name of the company.
Interactive Menus, yeah.
Pi R squared, Interactive Menus. Basically, we rather than put dishes on the menu, we just put ingredients, and you draw a circle around each one. The bigger the circle, more ingredients you have in your dish, and we balance that with our chef.
Yeah, yeah.
Put some wasabi on the side, and it's sorted.
And if you're vegan or gluten-free, then it's either a triangle or a square. You have to pay a little bit more extra for that, but we cater for everybody. We're inclusive.
We are.
Right. Well, I think we got that sorted.
Yeah.
When you touched upon this before, being the OG of improv schools in London, you look confused when I said that.
I didn't know what OG means.
I know. That's why. I thought I just picked up on that.
That's very upsetting.
Original gangster. Being the original. Being the OG of the improv world, was it challenging at all when these new improv schools appeared on the scene? And then sort of like, you know, you've gone from being the guys, and now there's a few of you around.
It was challenging. It's very personally challenging, and I think that's something you just have to you go through some like personal development with that. And
right,
you're not alone with that. That's any creative field and any business in any market. So we live in like a hyper capitalist country with the run by a government that's very much about free market, and whether you love it or hate it, like, that's what we're in.
Yeah.
One, you can't live in a cloud cuckoo land where you think you can just run something forever and, like, no one else is going to do the same thing the second you
but
start.
But you had a good run.
You had it. Yeah, it just doesn't work. You've got to be like, oh no, there's another improv place in my city of 8 million people. So one, it's like, throw the fuck up and, like, throw some balls and, like, or breasts, both helpful. It's no gender divide about that. I mean, basically, that's the main point, but then still do have emotional challenges. So first thing to know is, like, I mean, we weren't the original, like, we were a new improv company once. So when we started in London, there was a spontaneity shop, was there, Sprout Ideas, Crunchy Frog Collective, Comedy Players. So when we started, we were also, like, the new improv company.
Okay, yeah.
And then since then, we've seen other new improv companies pop up, and some have gone, and some popped up and stayed. And I think it depends. There's two different ways to look at it, really. It's funny you should ask me now, because I'm kind of, like, over the emotional development of it.
I'm good.
More kind of hindsight. But if you asked me 2 years ago, I would have been a right old mess.
Right.
If you look at it from a business point of view, so I was studying an MBA part-time just before lockdown started, but I paused it while lockdown's on, because I don't really want to do a Zoom university. But if you look at it purely from a business point of view, a marketing point of view, it's so straightforward. And it's just, like, such a normal thing that happens in any market that, you know, literally people who don't know anything about improv, they just look at, like, websites of all the four major improv companies in London.
Yeah.
And, oh, that one's got that thing. That one's got that thing. That one's not sure yet. That one needs marketing advice. And that's pretty much what they thought straight away. So you just have to, like, from a business point of view, they're like, of course someone else is going to be there. That's stupid. And that's just marketing. You just need to grow up and get on with it. And just make, like, stronger marketing choices about, like, who are you for? What's your improv company all about? Why is it different? Where is it? And then also just the awareness that London, I mean, we're not even in the rest of the UK yet, but London's massive. Like, London's got, well, pre-lockdown, 7 or 8 million people there, plus another extra 10 million commuting into work there.
Yeah.
So to kind of, like, get distracted by the fact that there's other improv companies is kind of ridiculous, because you're like, the challenge isn't other improv companies. The challenge is people don't know what improv is even this long into our company existing.
Mm.
And the other thing about London is, like, there's not only is there that big population, but it changes all the time, because people finish uni and move there, and older people move away from there. So even if you fuck up your marketing for a year, there's an entirely new audience along, like, 2 years from now. So that's the kind of cold business, Steve, point of view of it, which is, like, I've got literally written on my wall behind me. It's hidden by my kids' drawings. It just says focus on the audience. That's written about four times on my wall, really big. And, like, whenever we depart from that, that's when Hoopla fucks up. Whenever we're like, oh, what's so-and-so doing? We should do that. Or, oh, they're doing this, we should do that. Or, oh, what are you going to do about this? They're doing that. It's just like, no, that's stupid.
Yeah,
we've got thousands of people that know about us and are connected to us. And you just have to focus on your audience and focus on what do you want to do, what's fun for you, because we're not making, it's not like an oil mining industry. Focus on what's fun for you. Do that. Focus on what's fun for your audience. What do they want? And that's, and then their friends come along. It's like, it's not really a complicated business to be in. Anyway, so that's cold, hard business, Steve. But the more emotional side of it, yeah, it is difficult because, yes, maybe, I don't know if I'd want to live in a kind of more collective society where there's one improv company, and then you're like, hey, let's all pool our resources together and make improv a big thing. I don't know if that would work. And then also there's a thing I quite like, what I found helpful for me, funny enough, was Carl Jung, the psychologist, and he talks about archetypes, and there's an archetype of the shadow. And I think that's why competition in the creative industry can be difficult, because for me, it's like, if you're running a company, you make certain decisions of what you're going to do, but then the opposite of that is there becomes a shadow of what you're not doing. So if you're like, we're more about improv for fun, people doing it in their spare time, the shadow of that is like, hey, your improv's unprofessional. What about professionals wanting to be on TV and blah, 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 blah. So when you get presented by that, a company kind of like kind of taking a different market position. It also weirdly triggers you off because they're kind of doing the shadow side of you that you're not doing.
Right. And
you can trigger yourself into being like, oh my God, I thought of that 5 years ago. So you just have to remind yourself, like, actually, we're making choices here. Generic improv company probably wouldn't work. Like, trying to please everyone, I don't think it's a very good business decision. So, like, you just have to make a kind of strong choice of, like, here's what we're doing, and kind of let everyone do what they're doing. And then it becomes much easier, I think. And then also it becomes an artistic decision. It's like, you know, if there's a style, because improv splits into different styles, which from people outside the improv scene probably seems ridiculous, but it does, much like any art form. So then you just have to make a strong choice of, like, are we doing all these styles, or are we doing this, or what, you know, what are we doing? And again, but then that decision yet again comes down to, like, checking in with yourself. What do you actually want to do? What do your audience enjoy? So to cut a long story short, yes, it has personal emotional challenges, but that's life. And they're largely overcome by just as long as you focus on the joy of why you got into it in the first place. Really, that's it.
That's a great answer. Perfect.
Hello, sorry to interrupt in the middle of this insightful conversation, which I'm enjoying, I'm sure, just as much as you are. But I need to give you guys a little reminder. If you like this conversation, this episode, if you like balancing acts in general, then please do subscribe to us, rate and review us, because it makes the world of difference. And the more reviews we get, the more rates we get, the more people can discover the podcast and we can make it go viral, whatever that means. Okay, back to the chat.
Was it an exciting moment when you opened your sort of like own improv venue?
Yes, it was. And it was quite a gradual moment. So it's like, it gets exciting because going back to one of our points where we never got investment or anything. So everything's been very gradual.
Yeah. Cause I remember the Miller, as it was previously called the Miller.
Yeah.
You were just putting on shows there infrequently. Yeah. And yeah. I remember doing shows there. I don't remember how many years ago it was. But then Now, obviously, it's like the Hoopla venue, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So that was again just like a very gradual thing. So at first we were there. And we've been in some other pubs around London before, just doing one Tuesday a week in different groups and performers, much like a lot of stand-up comedy nights start, you know, just running a once-a-week thing. Well, once a month first, then once a week.
Yeah.
Big jump, by the way. And then we moved to the Miller and we're just there once a week. And it's just sort of year on year. Other promoters of different stuff, used to be more of a music venue, but other promoters would sort of stop. And then we were doing well, you know, just build up good relationships there. And then they'd just be like, do you want to do another night? Okay, yes. Next year, do you want to do another night? Yes. Next year, do you want another night? Yes. And then eventually, we didn't have the weekend, so I knew that would be a big thing because it's obviously a lot easier to get a big audience at the weekend, and kind of like the kind of party atmosphere of it. So I emailed the manager a little showreel of UCB in New York at their real peak as well, and some pictures of like their shows looking packed and being really good, and just the sort of vibrancy of like what a big party the atmosphere that was. And I was like, do you want me to do this upstairs every Friday and Saturday? And that's the only thing I put in the email. And then he said, I'll come in for a meeting. So I came in and he's like, what is this place? And I was like, oh, this is what improv's like. And I said, I think in London, it's getting a bit of a rep as being, it's always had a bit of a reputation for being, you know, kind of not too popular, small audiences. I said, I think it could be really mainstream. And I think we could do that here if we just sort of jazzed up the venue a bit. So that was that, really. So that was like when we jumped to being full time. So he just sort of said, go for it. And yeah, it was pretty cool. I'm not sure. I think it was, I mean, simultaneously, it was kind of weird because the music industry there, like a lot of music venues, I don't know why, but was dying off. So like they used to get bands there all the time, but there seems to be less and less bands were asking to perform there. And when they did, they just weren't bringing any audience in at all. And the venue was just like, we just can't support this. But at the same time, stand-up and improv was bringing in a lot of people. So I don't know why I don't know if that's a across London thing, but the audience seems to change quite a lot.
It's almost like you improvise. Obviously, there's loads of planning that's gone into it, but like through these various stages, you kind of improvised as you've gone along in terms of building where you're at now, did you have like a grand vision at the beginning of like, okay, this is where I want it to go? And like, are you heading in that direction?
It's a good question. So so a weird thing happened to us because we're old enough, which is, you know, you hear about having a 5-year plan. So we actually got to the end of a 5-year plan. And like, the weird thing is when you get to the end of one, you realize that you're like, whoa, what do I do now? So we had a year or so where I kind of got to the end of the 5-year plan of Hoopla and also my personal plan of what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And then you realize when you got to the end of it, it means you now have no plan, which is like even worse than having, I don't know, sorry, I'm babbling on. If you're 3 years into a 5-year plan, you don't have a 5-year plan, you have a 2-year plan.
Right, yeah.
Right. So we did make, I don't know if it's an error as such, but yeah, we definitely, a couple of years ago, I was like, shit, I'm struggling now because I'm no longer kind of moving forwards. And I'm someone that I like moving forwards. I like having things to work towards. But I was like, we've done everything we set out to do, which is awesome. But I'm now kind of repositioned as like just trying to manage this crazy, this crazy fucking place. I feel like Kermit the Frog because, you know, we've expanded like super quick. It's chaos because it's improv, like the shows, the classes. It's really fun. It's really vibrant. Yeah. Exactly what I wanted. Kind of have to readjust almost your personality as the leader a little bit to be like, right, shit, I'm just keeping this going now. Well, I didn't think it would... To tell you the truth, I didn't think it would work in the first place. So when you get there, you're like, fucking hell, I didn't think this would work. And you look back at these like schemes drawn on the back of an envelope from years ago. Cool, I've got this stuff. But previous Steve would be super proud of myself.
You allow yourself to be proud of yourself when you hit certain milestones. You don't. You're just kind of like on to the next thing.
Yeah, I'm just terrible. That's my wife is like, just, yeah. I should be a lot easier with myself. I know, because you can talk about... You said at the start of the podcast, I can take a mental health tangent, can't I? Yeah, I'm terrible. I don't, please don't. Yeah, I'm terrible. I've got nothing to pass on about that, really. Yeah, I think a lot of people running things have a crazy addiction to setting things up and are just absolutely awful, me included, at celebrating. And like, I never look backwards at all. I'm going to die and not remember anything, I'm afraid. I'm going to be like...
It's all right, you've got the next life.
On my deathbed, I'll be planning a... for the next year, and I'll be getting I just don't know, I don't really look backwards at all, and I'm quite good at present moment, so I'm quite happy in the present moment. I'm quite good at being positive about the future all the time, but
you embody the yes and. We've done that. Yeah, and
yeah exactly, I'm always looking for the and. But when I hit that point where we'd reached the end of the 5-year plan, so at first I struggled with it because I was like, I did go through a stage of like, do I want to be doing this anymore? Do I want to shift into a completely different career? Because I felt like I had this energy that is best spent on setting things up.
Right. Yeah.
And I had some ideas, but then also because we had a baby planned, I was like, oh, if I was 25, I probably would jump ship right now and just be like, put a bow on it and be like, that was great, I'm doing something new. But instead, I had to kind of like rechannel myself a little bit. So I went through a stage of kind of accepting that I was managing a company that was bigger than my experience and that I should do something about that. So I went through a stage of doing like a open university management course. And then I did a...
How long was that for?
So I just did a module for that, was about 8 months. Okay. It's really... I really recommend it for like people who are in the creative industries. If you just want to, you know, just for the sake of like an hour a day on your laptop. I got loads from that.
Oh, fantastic. Which university did you do that at?
So did the management module was with Open University online.
Okay. Yeah.
And then I started to do an MBA part-time at Sussex University near Brighton, where I live. But that's because of when lockdown came in. And so those things for me have been a bit like, it's almost like we built a house and then now I've learned how we should have built it. And then I'm going back and being like, right, let's tidy this bit up.
Right.
This is safe.
Because a lot of people say you get your real sort of learning and training done if you want to be kind of a entrepreneur through, you know, establishing and running a company. But I guess there are certain right and wrong ways of doing things.
Yeah, I think, I agree. I think training's changed a lot. I think a lot of people running companies now are a big fan, definitely me included, of getting the training that you need exactly as you need it. So,
right.
Like, I preferred the open university to the full MBA because I was a bit like, I don't really want to be spending my time writing an essay about some company that's not mine for weeks on end. It's quite academic.
Yeah.
Whereas the open university one, or you can do stuff like the Independent Theatre Commission have got training, or you can do, like, I think tailor-made training for leaders is the best.
Right.
Then I was like, I want to learn marketing. And then OU, they were like, your company is the company that you're going to write your report on. And I was like, oh, this is awesome, because I get to do, you're like kind of working on it as you go. And I think that's what people look for now. It's just kind of like the right training at the right time in the right place.
Tailor-made for them. Have you found delegation hard over the years as it's grown?
Yeah, so it used to be my weak spot, but now, no, I don't, I'm good at it now.
What do you think changed?
Just time, I'm afraid. Yeah, so at first I was terrible at it. I had people paid to, that I brought in to help temporarily, and I just couldn't let myself give them work to do.
You want to control everything?
Yeah, or I just give them stuff that just didn't matter. So it's just like, at the end of the year, I was looking at my accounts, it's like, I've paid so much money on something that just wasn't effective. What I found helpful now, I'm very lucky because I got the two main people I've got. Well, we've got lots of people work for us in different ways, but in terms of the core administration team, there's Jesse managing our courses and Angela managing our shows, and they're so good now that it's just such a healthy relationship. Like, that's enabled us to grow. Like, once you get a core team like that, for me, I think what helped the most was to not just think like, what's a repeatable thing that I'm always doing at the moment, and kind of like first train people up in that, because that frees up suddenly loads of time. If you're like, I'm always doing this 4 hours a week, be that like answering emails or setting up events or something. And the beauty of it is, once you've trained up people in that, and then you see them a couple of months later and they're doing what you used to do, but they're doing it tons better because they come up with a better system. So I think it's about delegating, but also I think the other important part of delegating is, and I got this from the OU course, is to always put in the why. So if people have got the overall picture of like why you're doing stuff, just like, can you clear this inbox? It's kind of like, well, that's boring. But if you're like, we're building a theatre, we're coming back from COVID, we're going to relaunch in such and such, people need to build up trust with us, so we need to be on top of emails and turn them around within 12 hours, then that's the kind of bigger why. So having people part of that, I think, is really important. I think the other thing I got from all the courses was, when you get bigger, that it's not just your vision anymore, because otherwise it's like, people might not like that vision and they won't want to work on it. So you got to kind of give up a bit of your ego and just be like, this is beyond me, so we're going to find a vision together. So, you know, rather than just say, here's the plan for next year, you say, what do you guys want to do next year? What would be fun? And it's quite fun because usually we've all got the same ideas anyway. So, you know, we're like, when we can run big, crazy events again, what would you like to do? And everyone was like, we want to run a big international improv festival, hire out a theatre for a couple of weeks and get people coming along from all over the world and have a massive party as well. So yeah, people have involved from the start. In a way, you don't have to delegate as much because they'll just know what to do anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I definitely agree with you though. It's one of the, it's like, I was really bad at it. Like for like 2 years, really awful. Like real Achilles heel.
Yeah, well, it's great that you turn a corner with it. So in terms of RY for Circles, we're disrupting the menu industry. You know, it's been stale for a long time. There's a new kid on the menu block, and that's our why.
Well, yeah, but then I agree. And then you've got to look for the deeper why. So there's a technique called, you have to ask why five times. So you
just look in the mirror. You go, why?
You go, why do you want to do this? Blah, blah, blah. Why do you want to do that?
Oh,
blah,
yeah. Blah, okay.
That. And it's the kind of like, the really core why is the thing where, that kind of can drive a team, set a vision, and also help your marketing. Because if you're all in sync with the core why. So for me, with the menu thing, I think it's, I think for me, a big why would be to enable people to have more interest in the ingredients in their food and the effects of those ingredients on their body. So like,
genius.
if you're feeling tired every day at 2 o'clock, rather than thinking that's normal, maybe really think about, like, what did you put in your mouth before 2 o'clock? And then you'll probably find that you're having something quite bready, maybe some sugar at about 1 o'clock, and your body's just having a reaction to it. So
I'm kind of regretting us now talking about this on the podcast, because someone else is going to listen to this and just take our idea. But it's fine, because we're not holding on to our egos. There's 8 million people in London.
Yeah.
There's room for everyone. There's room for more circles-led menu businesses.
Yeah, definitely. I reckon there's at least room for 5.
Yeah, no more. 5's the max. Otherwise, we're going to move on to the next thing.
Yeah. Otherwise, yeah, you fall off the front page of Google. Yeah.
You do the Google things. Do you do a lot of that then? I'm assuming you must do the online marketing. Does that sound the online marketing? Do you do a lot of that? Are you on Yale.com?
But Steve, I'm afraid that's the only thing I'm not going to tell you much in detail of, because it's so valuable.
It's dark arts, isn't it?
Dark art. It is dark art. So what I'm going to say, like, just if you're setting up a business, learn it, because you're crazy, because it's where everyone finds you these days.
Yeah.
I want to tell you loads.
Sorry, you can tell me after. Yeah.
I'm surprised people don't learn it though. Just like buy a book on it. Just learn it.
Yeah. I think if I speak from experience, like I just, a wall comes up with that side of things. With marketing in general, just I have a bit of an allergy to it, and I need to get over it.
Yeah.
And also I guess it's different. Like it depends on what the purpose is for. If you've got a business, you've got someone else doing that for you. I was going to say, like, I don't want to, I've talked about this on the podcast before. I just don't want to kind of get into that hole of like having to check my phone all the time to see all the stats on social media and everything, you know?
I think that's why I think Google marketing is probably the least stressful, because Google marketing is basically just find what people are looking for.
Yeah.
And then deliver that. And then that's it, really.
Yeah. So
that's kind of like, I always think of it as advertising the other way around from normal, because everything else is like, look at us, come do this. Where Google, someone's literally saying, you know, I want a circular menu system. And if your website is called circularmenusystems.com, you're probably going to be at the top. And then if your opening line is like, hello, we do the best circular menu systems in London, then they're probably going to pick you unless you've done something else completely stupid.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the Google stuff is for people, for listeners who are just setting out a kind of business and is interested in online marketing, I think just the basics of getting to the top of Google and Google Ads are actually kind of simple. There's even just a book in W.H. Smith's that's really just called, it's just on the magazine back, it's just called How to Set Up an Online Business. And it's all there. And I think talking about a difference in sales of like tens of thousands of pounds a year, I think it's, you know, to not do it is kind of silly.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so I will back to just like the improv scene as a whole. Historically, the US has always been like ahead of the game in terms of, you know, the level of improv and just the different, just how big that whole scene is there, and how many performers have gone through the improv world, and, you know, there's like a whole structure there, you could do SNL, etc., etc. Do you think that we're catching up over here in the UK in terms of like the quality of the improv shows, and also in terms of the opportunities that it can lead to for performers?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes splits into kind of like pre-COVID world and then after.
Yeah, of course. Right? Yeah.
So I don't know. To answer as myself in from February, I'd say yes. And like, it's kind of sad to think about it now. I try to not think about it too much. But like how it was crazy, like how busy, not just us, but all improv companies in London were getting last year. It's another reason to go back to the competition thing, where it became, I think, less of an issue, because improv was becoming so big.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. Like how many people were booking classes and how far ahead, like this isn't just us, this is like loads of companies were booking ahead. And then also the live shows with us, and I think most other places, we're just getting packed. Like we'd never had it before. Like, so last year, selling out like weekend shows all the time at full price tickets. And then, and like before, man, I'm gonna cry. No, before, like it's saying it's recently, it's December. We were phoning around the big theatres like the Soho Theatre and the Leicester Square Theatre, because we really needed a bigger theatre to show off some of the groups that are coming up with us. So this big one was called The Playground, which is produced by Maria Peters and Lauren Shearing, which is an all-female improv night, but it's not marketed as all female. It just happens to be. but it's not in any of the press. But it's just a really good improv night, and they get people like J.C. Lawrence guesting, like one of the original Whose Lines It Anyway.
Yeah.
So that was packed at our theatre and always sold out once a month. So we're like, we're talking to them about taking that bigger. There's a bunch of other shows that were getting bigger. So we were planning to do like more kind of regular West End-y things. And I think the TV industry's changed now. So I don't think any casting director sees improv as weird, which is what some of them used to like 10 years ago. And now I think it's even seen as like an essential thing. If you're doing like an advert or comedy, they'll directly ask for improv experience. So I think that's a big change. So to answer your question, yeah, as long as things recover from COVID, okay, then yeah, it was definitely on that track that people were getting picked up for. I mean, we had it happen with our shows, like people were kind of spotted on stage and then they're going to bigger shows or they're performing at the Comedy Store Players. And we had a bunch of people that ended up with sketches on BBC Three. So yeah, and I think it's kind of like, I think the London scene like that's almost joyfully messy. So I personally think there were some, I don't know if I should say this, but I think it's come out a bit this summer. I think there were some problems a little bit with the US improv scene, where it was almost so tightly managed, like the pathway from doing IO all levels or Second City all levels, and then have to move to Chicago. And then maybe one person in the theatre will take a liking to you and put you forward for an audition, and then you magically become on Saturday Night Live. So that's fine, but it has had a load of issues with it, where you're basically trapping people into a cycle of spending thousands and thousands of pounds on levels for potentially years. Whereas I think the London scene is almost more joyfully messy in a good way, where, you know, people train not just with us, people train lots of different improv companies. They hear about stuff from shows, they get spotted at shows, they do auditions independently. Sometimes we get emails to people being like, we're looking for this, can you spread a casting word? And it's sort of like just a kind of lovely chaos of creativity. But yeah, I think as long as things go back, then yes, I think improv, like, unfortunately, was definitely on a very healthy, fast trajectory to the mainstream. I think it will. I think there are there's various improv-based TV shows in the background that I think are in development. And then there's one on Netflix over the summer. So a TV industry is again showing an interest in it, which I think that will be a big thing as well.
Yeah, it's fucking COVID, eh? Fucking COVID.
Yeah.
So you're doing everything, I take it, via Zoom at the moment. Are you doing Zoom-based improv classes?
Yeah, we're doing a bit of both. So we've got real-life workshops and shows back, but just with like a lot less people. And we've got a load of safety stuff in place, but then also been running Zoom since March as well.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because we're smaller than we used to be, like this time last year or even as recently as February.
Yeah.
But we're doing enough to kind of keep ticking on. And then, so I think our kind of our pathway to recovery is okay. And as long as things kind of start getting better next year, you know, I'm not reading the news or anything at the moment because you just.
It's probably a good thing.
Sometimes you read an article and you're like, oh, I don't know if I could cope with the idea of us not being back properly for another 2 years or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're just following all the guidelines from Department of Culture, Media and Sport.
That must be a bloody headache. So many guidelines. And I mean, look, I get it. You've got to do it. But I mean, what a ball ache.
It is. And they change all the time as well. So, like, do them all. And then there's a tweet from Matt Hancock at 1 a.m. You're like, what? I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah. Some of them probably don't even make any sense. There's no logic behind them. Yeah. None of it makes sense. Yeah. The scientists are all wrong. Not, I mean, obviously, scientifically.
Nothing about this year makes sense.
Nothing makes sense. But like, some of these. Okay, look, I'll give you an example. Right? I'm not going to go off on a big COVID rant.
Yeah.
But it's a whole other podcast. But you can go, I think, like, the latest ruling is if you go into a restaurant, you have to wear the mask while you walk to your table. And then when you get to your table, you can take it off.
Yeah.
Really? Like what? So someone's going to catch COVID between the time you walk from the restaurant to the table. Then as soon as you can take it off, you can cough and splatter everywhere all over the table.
Yeah, that's right.
That doesn't make sense to me.
No, nothing makes sense anymore. Yeah, I mean, we haven't do that at our venue because they like people come to our shows, and I'm in like full mask, hand sanitizer, they're in masks, take them to the table. We've got seats, so we've converted our venue from, you know, rows to being like cabaret seating. But then once they're there for the show, yeah, they order drink and food from the app. But then obviously when the food arrives and drink arrives, it's masks off. So I don't know. So I'm just like,
it's just so random. I went to a meditation retreat last weekend, and you have your designated seats where you're meditating. While you're meditating, you have to wear the mask. But before the meditation, while they're giving a talk, you can take it off.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not saying they're doing anything wrong, but they're just going on the guidelines that they've been given. So I just, people are just like sitting in an office, like yes anding. Yeah, and when they sit down, they should wear the mask. Yeah, and but before the meditation, they should just take it off.
So I actually wrote to Oliver Dowden recently. He's the MP and he's in charge of the Department of Culture, Media and Sport. Because I was finding myself getting really frustrated in the middle of the year, just never knowing what was going to happen. And then I was like, right, actually, I'm going to try and help out. So I've written to them and just volunteered and said, do you want me to come in one day a week?
And what did they say?
We haven't written back.
Oh, see, that's just.
So I'm going to, but I mean, they're going to get a lot of emails right now. So I'm going to wait a week and I'm going to write back again and be like, do you want me to help write guidelines for amateur drama groups or something? Because
it's a lovely idea.
Because behind the scenes, whoever's making the key decisions, that's one thing. But then at the end of the day, it's going to be a bunch of like young civil servants who are having to decipher the thick information and write it for the entire arts scene. And I think the quicker the arts gets safely back, the better. And I think it's pretty, I just don't know anything anymore. But I think whatever happens, I think it'd be a shame, obviously a shame, if the entire arts and events industry doesn't come back properly. And the amount of people's jobs that have been ruined by this year is awful. So I think, you know, we've got to work it out, really. You can't just give up.
Yeah, it's very true. I'm sure there must be people advising them within the arts industries. They would have thought, in terms of like protocol, who knows with this government?
I don't know, really. I mean, that was very noticeable at the start. There was like, at the start of all this, it felt like all the theatres were just like looking around for leadership, but there wasn't really anything. So they just started looking for each other. And people were just like being like, well, when are you coming back? When are you coming back? And we were all finding each other. Being like, so back in April and May, we were like, when are you planning to come back? It was like, I don't know. There isn't any really announcement about that. But I mean, people didn't really know what the thing was then.
No.
But I think it's a little bit clearer now.
Yeah. All right. So moving away from COVID, going to move 2 meters away from the COVID chat. And you moved a few years ago to Brighton. You escaped from London. Did you do that because you just needed to get away from the city? And if so, how has that had an impact on your well-being?
Oh, so it wasn't what you thought, really. I wasn't escaping. I really love London and I miss it a lot. We were starting a family, and London was way too expensive. And funny enough, back then, I can't remember what it was, about 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Brighton was cheaper. And also my wife's mum and brother and sister lived here.
Okay.
So there's choices of like, could be near my parents in Wimbledon, which is now super expensive, where we couldn't really afford to buy anything. Or we could be near her parents in Brighton. So yeah, I'm afraid it's just a sort of boring.
You're ahead of the curve because now everyone's sort of wanting to move out of London. And
yeah, I've heard that. Yeah, lockdowns made people want to leave. And so there you go. But yeah, it would have been here a while. But I haven't really left London at all because I'm there all the time. I'm there like 3 days a week, even now, this year. And then usual times, I'm there like 5 days a week.
Is there a challenge commuting, or is it? It's only 40 minutes, isn't it? Something
about an hour. And I just all my emails on the train. Like, you just have your little office.
Right.
Everyone's got their little train office going, or their little train cinema. Everyone's doing something. The other day I was like typing away, listening to my meditation music. And I thought, oh, headphones aren't working. I need to get some new ones. So I turned it up full volume to get enough volume. And then I realized someone came like waving at me from a couple of rows away, and my headphones weren't plugged in. So just in my head. And my laptop had just been blaring out this like meditation music, like really loud. So at least it gave people a chuckle. But yeah.
At least it wasn't like a self-help audio, like an Anthony Robbins type. That was sort of embarrassing.
No. No, it wasn't. It wasn't that.
Okay. And outside of running Hoopla, then, I'm sure you have very limited time because you're also a father. It's a funny word, father. It sounds very formal.
Yes, father.
Father. You're a dad.
Yes.
What historically have you done to relax and unwind outside of business?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, hopefully it definitely is a sort of all-encompassing thing.
Mm.
For me, really, I think when I'm on a good track and for having a good time and, you know, mentally feeling with it, it's all about the exercise, really, much like yourself. Like, it's always something, if I'm doing like running or cycling or swimming or going to the gym a couple of times over the week, then I'm kind of usually on good form and in good spirits. So that's the main thing.
Yeah.
And then also, I have to say, the pub. after an improv workshop or show, I think that's quite therapeutic. I do like to muck around in a pub with a bunch of people.
Yeah.
Matter who, actually. I just sort of like do an improv thing and I'm just like, I'm going to the pub and then see who's there.
Your social circle must be massive. Like, you must have, so many friendships must have formed over the years of running Hoopla.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that. So yeah it is. So like, if I just turn up the Miller, you will know a lot of people.
Yeah.
But lockdown, I was like, no one phones me. And I was just like, I'm just, none of my friends, like, we never phone each other and be like, arrange to go somewhere. With improv, you're just like, you just know, if you go to the improv on Friday or Saturday, it used to be like, I know there's going to be tons of people there, I know, so I'll go there, watch the show, or just hang out. And that was like our thing, so it's kind of like our social club.
Yeah.
And 3 months into it, my friend Liam, he was like, oh, I really miss seeing everyone. I was like, yeah, like, we haven't been, no one's been phoning each other. So then we're finally getting around to it. Improv, pre-COVID, it was sort of chaotically sociable in a good way. So yeah, I miss... I definitely miss that. There's like a sequence of funny little pubs around London that end up near improv workshops. And suddenly they're like, why are we so busy on a Monday night when like 3 or 4 classes have all finished at bang on 9:30 and they've all turned up at the same pub?
Yeah, well, I remember we used to go to that one when you did the workshops off Brick Lane, in the cloth factory.
Yes.
Do you remember we used to go to a pub opposite? Yeah, that was really cool.
The Pride of Spitalfields.
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah, that was so good, that one. It's like it hadn't changed in decades, and in a good way.
Yeah. So, and also, so you're saying on your story about the meditation being played out loud of the trains. Do you meditate often?
Yeah. So I do. What I found helpful is the Alexander technique. So. So I go to someone about once a month or so to actually do the Alexander technique with them.
What do you use it for? Because you can do it for different things, can't you? It can be used for different things, like whether it's posture or whether it's for, you can even do it for swimming. There's all sorts.
Yeah, so I went there for posture. I have to say, I didn't do anything for that. I've still got awful posture.
Right.
Then I accidentally found it was just really helpful for practicing. It's basically like, it's a really nice way to just, I just use it to kind of stop for a bit so I don't bring stress from one event into another event. So if I've been running around all day doing the admin for Hoopla, but then I've got a teacher workshop, so I just make sure you get there 1/4 hour early. I just lie down, put my head on a book, semi-supine position, so you lie on your back with your kind of knees.
Don't you fall asleep? When I used to do it, I always used to fall asleep.
Yeah, you can do, because it's sort
very
of
relaxing.
What you need, really. So if you're tired, it's just, you just, your body's like, oh, I'm tired, I'm going to sleep. So,
right, yeah.
Anything. I'm a big fan of like the quick nap, Steve. So
I love a power nap. How long do your power naps consist of? What duration of time?
I don't know, 15 minutes maybe.
20 minutes is supposed to be the cutoff. After 20 minutes, you get you get a bit fucked. You get drowsy.
Yeah, I have to, you know, put an alarm on 15 minutes before a workshop or before a show, and you just sort of wake up, and then you're kind of there for that event rather than, you know, thinking about all this other stuff.
Yeah.
So I just kind of use it to like let go of things a little bit, and then come back to them later. Every Monday morning especially, so when I start the week, I get up and just do that, kind of do it for about 2 hours actually. I just sort of lie on my back for like 2 hours before work starts, and just sort of, you know, you're not even planning, you're just like, it's weird, you just wake up after you get up after a couple of hours of it, and then you just sort of know what you need to do that week. It's like you just give yourself that chance to not just always be working, but also like work out what you should be working on and what you can kind of like not worry about. So yeah.
Very good. Very measured, Steve. So yeah, it sounds like you're in a very, very zen place overall. Everyone's got you on a good day, but you seem to be very, would you say you're overall feeling very sort of balanced?
What, today or life in general?
In general. We'll go today.
Yeah. So I mean, a major thing that I missed out, so I wasn't because of the COVID thing potentially cocking up our whole business and industry,
yeah,
wasn't very balanced about that.
Yeah, of course.
I got help with it. So I did hypnotherapy because March and April, I was just like, right, we need to make sure we don't fold.
Yeah.
And we don't fuck up. So I was like, we need to start doing online and make that work. So that was cool. In a way, that was good because we had something to focus on. And then May and June, I was like, great, let's keep doing that and let's start planning to reopen because I'm sure things will be back in autumn. And then August and September, you're like, fuck, things aren't back to normal. And they're not going to be back to normal for a long time. And then I had to like fully kind of accept that. So I was getting really angry. And I was sort of projecting the anger onto Dominic Cummings, for instance, like a lot of people, and getting quite, you know, just having like, and then feeling really depressed about it all and like helpless. And also I was feeling like a massive failure because I was like, all my friends from school or uni who weren't in the arts, completely financially unaffected by all this. And I was like, oh, this is just proving to them that I'm fucking stupid and I chose like a rational, foolish life path.
Yeah.
And proving to my dad that, and I was getting all these like big status anxiety things, which weren't really founded in anything because people didn't really think like about me at all.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I went to a hypnotherapist and I really recommend it. It's kind of like therapy for lazy people because I was like, she's like, what do you want from this? I said, I just want to do the best we can to recover, but I want to stop feeling shit about this year. And I want to feel successful rather than a failure because I need to stop blaming myself for COVID because I thought I was kind of like, I'm so used to accepting responsibility with Hitler that I was blaming myself for like not seeing this pandemic happen and not reacting to it in January rather than waiting till March. Anyway, so then she hypnotizes you, did about 4 sessions. And then since then, this is about a month ago, I've been feeling really good. And I've just been like, cool. You know, I don't have any control over that. I don't have any control over government decisions unless they finally let me in and volunteer there. But there's loads of stuff I can control, like what we do, and I can, you know, do the best we can. So I've been feeling more positive about that and not beating myself about it all, which I was in the summer.
Great. Well, I'm glad that's worked. I've never done hypnotherapy. Actually, no, I did do it. I lie. I did it. My mum made me do it before my GCSEs because I just couldn't focus. The phrase the hypnotherapist gave me was narrow down. Yeah. And when I was supposed to say that over and over again, I
Supposed
to focus. But I got 2 Bs, 4 Cs, 3 Ds and 2 Es in my GCSEs. So it didn't really work.
Unless he got you to narrow down accidentally onto just the 2 Bs.
Just the 2 Bs, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what he would argue. We want our money back. He's got 2 Bs. Wouldn't have got those Bs if he hadn't narrowed down.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe I'll try it again. Okay, yeah. And I want to ask you, are there any books that you have read that stand out, that have had an impact on you or have inspired you?
Yeah, a lot, really. I think it depends, you know, where you're at. So it depends. So there's certain books I'll go back to. I'll just talk about them because I could go on for ages about books. Yeah. There's one to get me motivated again in terms of moving forwards, which is The Magic of Thinking Big by Dr. Hawkes. I don't know if you know that one.
No.
And I read that because I read Paul Merton's autobiography and he mentioned it in the book. He was going through a tough time and he was like, all I did was just spent a summer reading this book, The Magic of Thinking Big.
Okay.
And it's very much like, you know, it gives you confidence. It's like, you can do this. It kind of removes excuses that you have in yourself sometimes. So that's good. I always feel quite healthy when I do that. Usually when it's my birthday, I will head off and read that for a couple of days and that gets me in good spirits.
Every year you go off and read it?
Yeah, pretty much.
It's a nice ritual.
Yeah, it's a good ritual. Like one year I went off on holiday by myself to the Lake District for 3 days with just that book. And I went walking all day in the Lake District, read that book. But then after 2 days, I was like, I really miss people. What am I doing here by myself? I thought I wanted to be like a hermit. And then I realized actually I just needed a little break. And after 2 days, I just headed off back home early and was like, oh, I missed stuff.
What do you find that you think about when you're walking? Do you just let your mind go into free fall or do you tend to have specific things on the agenda that you want to mull over?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I get it with running and swimming as well. I don't really try and control the mind. I just sort of think, I think walking is very healthy.
Yeah.
I think it's weird. It's almost like your subconscious is busy solving some problem and then you're walking, you're admiring the scenery, you're always feeling good. I always feel good on a walk. And then out of nowhere, it'll just deliver this sort of bombshell, amazing idea. And you're like, oh yeah. And I think also there's something about a view, right? If you're going through problems or creative challenges or you're worried about a perceived competition. If you sort of stood on top of a mountain, it just, everything, it looks so, you're just like, oh, that doesn't matter. Like, that's fine. I'll work it out. So I think it's kind of, it, you know, gives that perspective. So there's that one. And then the other one, the classic, which I should read, but I haven't read it for ages, which is How to Win Friends and Influence People. As someone who, I definitely had to learn social skills from scratch. I wasn't very, I didn't really born with them. So there's that one. If you just want to like learn good social skills from scratch, okay, you get them all the time. Yeah, and then I suppose the other top one would be Impro by Keith Johnston.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
One of the main improv books, because I think that's good for not just improv, but like creativity in general.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's those three probably my kids.
All right. Thank you. And do you, are you a podcast listener? Are you a podcast fan?
I'm afraid. I'm not. I don't know why.
There's enough content. There's too much content out there.
I couldn't really hear very well when I was a kid, so I didn't talk. I didn't learn to talk till I was five.
Really?
Yeah, I think because of that, if like lecture, like if there's, you know, like lectures at university, I'm not very good at. I just sort of drift away. So I'm more like visual and writing person.
Yeah, I'm the same.
Same with podcasts. So yeah, I don't do them.
Okay. Okay.
No,
none taken.
I blame my ears.
I'm going to ask you, taking up a lot of your time, so I'm going to ask you a final question that I ask all the guests on the podcast. What does the idea of balance mean to you or not?
Oh, okay. I think that's a really good question, mate. Funny enough, because I knew the theme of the podcast, so I knew that was coming. So it's really interesting because this isn't me pitching a course, by the way, because it's already underway and there's not another one on sale. But I happen to be teaching an online improv course about Carl Jung, the psychologist, psychiatrist, and mixing that in with improv. And that talks a lot about different kind of energies we have within us. Mm. So for me, balance now, I kind of accept that I'm lots of different people. So I'm no longer looking for like this sort of point where there's like this one me. And I used to kind of mistakenly think like, you know, am I someone who's interested in science or am I interested in drama? Because at school, you're forced to be like, no, you have to do 3 A-levels and they should all be around science or they should all be around arts. But I was like, but I like drama. And they're like, no, doesn't make any sense. And you go to uni, there's this other split. And then years later, I was like, well, it doesn't make any sense. Like, everyone could be interested in everything. So I have a drama side to me and I have a science side to me. I like hanging out with my 2-year-old. I also like hanging out with a load of blokes in a pub downing tequila. That's quite fun as well. And I like running. I also like eating kebabs. And I like watching the film Frozen. I also like Terminator 2. So the point being that I now, in terms of balance, I kind of think in a more kind of like, in a way, the way the ancient Greeks used to think, which is like, you're made up of loads of different kind of, not gods, as well, they gods, but not in a kind of the way we think of gods, but there's these different energies and your different energies at different times, depending on the situation. If you spend more time you spend too long in one energy, then the other one's going to get pissed off and rise up in an unhealthy way. So you have to exercise all these different things. So for me, that's balance. It's not trying to, balance doesn't mean like there's one me that's going to be like this. It's like just exercising all these things in life and not mistakenly thinking that we're only one thing. Yeah,
that's such a great answer.
Yeah, so yeah, we're all these things always. And then, and also being aware that when you, as you get older, there might be another thing that pops up and you'd be like, why do I want to grow courgettes? Like, I used to be into Nirvana. Why do I want to grow a courgette plant? It's just like, no, fuck, grow the courgette plant. That's your new grunge. Just grow the fucker and like learn some serious shit about yourself by nurturing some vegetables. So that's, if you feel uncomfortable with it, go and smoke a spliff afterwards and you'll balance out.
You've got some unique and original approaches to life. And I've always viewed you as a kind of visionary. You know, like you are like, with, you know, considering what you've done with like Hoopla, you're a trailblazer, really. And it's amazing to see what you've done, considering like back in the day, we're just like fucking around on stage and in, was it the Bedford back then? Or was it?
Yeah, Bedford, yeah.
Yeah, it's just a small group. And now, you know, we didn't touch upon it, but you're doing, not only you're doing shows, not only have you got your venue, you're doing all the corporate side of things as well.
Yeah.
Obviously, I know COVID has had a huge dent on it, but I'm sure when things get back to normal, it won't take long for things to get back to the way they were. I think, yeah, it's hugely impressive.
Oh, thanks, mate. I appreciate that. And funny enough, I appreciate what you said. And I think, like you said, back then it was fucking around on stage. In a way, to not lose that is the key to it.
Yeah.
It's fucking around on lots of stages all over the place. That's what's happening. Yeah. But whenever we go, and this becomes like the job as the leader in a way, is to be the sort of the values depository.
Yeah.
Of so you can go anywhere where Hoopla's happening and be like, no, that's not Hoopla. That's way too serious. What are you talking about? Right. Why are you getting this thing? Or to be like, yes, perfect. That's exactly what Hoopla is. And that becomes in terms of a long-term growth thing for a company, I think that's really important to be have people that totally get the whole point of it and the values, because then that's when you can grow without losing the kind of inner battery or hearts of what made it all along. I'd happily have on my gravestone Hoopla, Steve Hoopla, fucking about on a stage. that'd be great.
I'll make sure to pass that on if you go before me.
Well,
basically the way that I see it, I've just had a flash of the future. We build up the circles business. And it goes, it's massive, it's completely out of control, but we launch it in the US, we launch it in the Far East, everywhere. And we've agreed to go 50-50 on it, yeah. But greed gets the better of me. And I want to own the whole company. So yeah. I do what anyone would do in that situation. And I hire a hitman and we take you out of the game. But I always honor this conversation and I will have that put on your grave, because also I feel guilty because I pulled you out of Hoopla to focus on the circles business, and you always mulled over. I kind of did you a favor in a way, because you were never really yourself after that. So that's why I put, fucking about on stage on your grave. That was my giving back to you, and also being guilty for.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. I'm glad you did. I'm glad you never forgot that. I'm slightly alarmed that you didn't go for the whole management buyout situation or just a sort of delayed purchase of 50% shares or, any of that. But
it's not as exciting.
Man, at least you were committed to that decision, Steve.
Yeah.
So you saw that through. How does the hitman kill me?
I was going to say a dose of COVID, but it's not really appropriate, is it? Because
Well, you could get away with that these days, so that'd be quite a good way to kill someone.
Yeah. Yeah. Like poison you with COVID. Maybe you'd poison with COVID. But you've already had COVID, so you're immune. So actually, that's poor thinking by me. So actually, I try then, and you don't die. You come back, and then you do the management buyout, and then I'm out of the game.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds... this all takes place about 50 years from now, did you say?
I think it'd have to be a bit less than that, because we'll be quite elderly by then, won't we? Yeah. Probably won't be alive.
No.
I mean, maybe. Yeah. Maybe. Who knows? We have a good innings. All right. Where can people find out about what you're up to and Hoopla in general?
So the main places are website, hooplaimpro.com. Hooplaimpro.com. And we're also on all the social medias, hooplaimpro, all one word.
Okay, great. Fantastic.
Steve looked at me as if I was meant to say more then, but I'm afraid I didn't have anything.
No.
That's more catchy taglines.
Okay. Well, look, Steve, it's absolute pleasure chatting with you. You delivered lots of nuggets there.
Yes, chicken nuggets. And Steve, it's been a pleasure to be on. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you for talking to me. Perfect. And there we have it, Steve Rowe in the building via Zoom. A magnifique conversation, oui? So, in the next episode, I'm very excited about this one. We have got none other than Hayden Prowse from The Revolution Will Be Televised, BAFTA winning, no less, amongst many other shows. We'll be on the episode, on the podcast, for your audio pleasure. So look out for that one. And as always, I forgot to say this at the beginning, if you like this episode, if you like Balancing Acts and Generals, please do rate and review us in Apple and subscribe. Tell your friends, just be a good podcast listening citizen. That's all I ask. Nothing more. And then when, if we meet, we haven't met before and we meet and we strike up conversation, you can look at me, in the eyes
knowing that you've done the right thing. And I'll sense it. I will sense it. Either way, I'm just, you know, I'm good at that. I have a sixth sense of people that don't leave reviews of the podcast on Apple. So I'll just leave that out there for you. All right. Okay, people, until next time, see you later. Balancing Acts is made in association with The Comedy Crowd, who support independent comedy creators. They showcase the best new videos on comedycrowdtv.com and across media platforms. They support independent comedy creators and showcase the best new videos, including adult animation, sketch shows, web series, viral hits, and lots more. So if you're a creator, then do check them out.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.